I am inclined to think that while it is a very close race on the basis of the figures as they now stand on our board, Dewey has the best chance.
And Mr. Kaltenbarn was saying, while the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear.
The Dean of the Commentators. NBC News presents a special program in tribute to H.B. Kaltenbarn, Dean of Radio News Commentators, who died yesterday in New York. Here is NBC News correspondent Morgan Beatty.
He was 86 years old, but one could hardly believe it. Tall, with the rugged build and easy grace of an athlete, H.B. Kaltenbarn was an avid tennis player until only 2 years ago. He was an inquisitive, energetic, restless man. He was bluntly frank about his opinions on and off the air. But with it all, H.B. was a gentleman whose old-world courtliness, along with his Teutonic name, military mustache, and brisk staccato speech, gave rise to the belief that he was of European birth. Actually, Kaltenbarn was born in Milwaukee, the son of a Wisconsin merchant. He began his journalistic career in the small Wisconsin town of Merrill, where he went to work on a newspaper while still in his teens. From there, he went to Europe as a correspondent, joined the staff of the Brooklyn Eagle in 1902, then quit a few years later to work his way through Harvard, then back to Brooklyn, and shortly a new career.
How did I ever get into broadcasting? Back in 1922, a freak invention called radio was exciting popular interest. The owners of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, where I was an editor, thought radio might have possibilities. I was known for my gift of gab, and it was decided to make me the Brooklyn Eagle's radio voice. The mellifluous accents to which you are now listening did the rest.
And how familiar was that mellifluous voice to become to two generations of Americans? A few years ago, H.V. shared an NBC microphone with another broadcast old-timer, Mary Margaret McBride. He talked about those early years in broadcasting.
I was giving a series of current events talks in the auditorium of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. They came once a week. The auditorium was always filled. We always had to turn people away because at that time, it was in the beginning of the First World War, people were tremendously interested in current events. And so we began in that way, and they built up to a climax of interest. Then along in the early 20s came radio, and we realized that we could get a much larger audience. Instead of 500 people, which was all the Eagle Auditorium held, we could have as many as 50,000 if I'd go on the air. Well, that seemed tremendous, multiplying it by 50 or 100. And so we decided we'd put the programs on the air. My very first broadcast, as it happened, was made from Bedloe's Island, just behind the Statue of Liberty. There, the Signal Corps had established an experimental long-wave station, and I went there and talked for 30 minutes on current events. Mm-hmm. That was the first time that current events were analyzed on the radio, so that was one of the several firsts which I was fortunate enough to accomplish.
Kaltenbarn pioneered foreign reporting by wireless in the 30s when he broadcast direct from Europe on the Spanish Civil War, the bloody rehearsal for the world cataclysm that was to follow. Here is one of those broadcasts.
This is H.B. Kaltenbarn speaking to you from the famous Ematz Hotel at Hyundai, France, just across the Spanish border. I have just come from a talk with United States Ambassador Bowers, who returned today to France on the Cayuga with 17 refugees, including three Americans. He reports that the province of Galicia in the south, from which we have heard scarcely anything since the Spanish Revolution began, is entirely in rebel hands.
It was Kaltenbarn and his marathon reporting job during the Munich crisis in 1939 that brought radio journalism to maturity. Here he tells Miss McBride about it.
I was on the air practically all the time, night and day. They'd wake me up, a bulletin would come in, and I'd go on the air half asleep and analyze it.
It was going on all day long, interrupting every program, I guess.
Yes, constantly, because the interest of the United States reached a high point then that it has never reached except during very brief periods during the Second World War. For example, when we were expecting the peace with Japan, peace with Germany. Those highlight moments, of course, there was equal listener interest. But outside of that, I think the Munich crisis was really a top listening period for American radio.
I was also reading last night the account that you got from London at that time of when Chamberlain came back for the second time, how he was met by cheering crowds and everybody thought peace in our time, and there was talk of a knighthood for him. Do you remember all that?
Oh, yes. He was, of course, the great hero for the moment, because he had returned, and the British people, who knew they were not prepared for war, were gratified beyond all else that, for the moment at least, war had been avoided.
And in France, the same thing was happening.
And I remember I went on the air, and I said, "Today they ring the bells, tomorrow they may wring their hands." And that turned out to be very true, because I knew enough about Hitler and dictators in general to realize that every concession you make to them merely creates another demand. And that, by the way, is the lesson of history that we must bear in mind today, that there is a dictator government which is powerful and which is expanding and which is imperialist and which is aggressive, as our State Department has said. And such a government must be met with firmness, not with concessions, with directness, not with appeasement.
What thing did any man ever say to you that stands out right now in letters of red in your mind? Would it be Wilkie? Would it be Roosevelt? Would it be Hitler? Would it be Mussolini? All these you've interviewed. Or would it be some other one person?
Well, as you mentioned those names, a phrase flashed into my mind from Hitler's angry when I defended the Jews of Germany. "You are wrong." He just roared it at me. And it made quite an impression, because I knew that I was right and that he was wrong. And I said to myself at the time, "Well, I can't answer you now, but the world will answer you." Mm-hmm. And it did.
But those of us who lived through the stormy years of the first part of this century probably remember H.V. best as a political commentator and reporter. Here he tells how Franklin D. Roosevelt would be nominated for the third time during the 1940 Democratic Convention.
Senator Lister Hill, Democrat of Alabama, says tonight that he will put President Roosevelt in nomination for a third term in a four-minute address from the convention platform. Alabama will be the first state in the nomination roll call, which will follow immediately after the completion of Senator Wagner's address, and then the President of the United States will be formally placed in nomination in this brief nomination speech, a record in brevity, by Senator Hill of Alabama. At the end of the roll call of states, in the course of which two men will be nominated, in addition to the President of the United States for a renomination, namely, Chairman James A. Farley of the National Committee, the Postmaster General, and John Nance Gardner, the Vice President of the United States, after those two men have been nominated, as the roll of states is called, then, before the result of the balloting is announced, James A. Farley tells NBC that he has arranged with the chair, Senator Barclay, to be recognized. And then he will come to the platform and will move that Franklin D. Roosevelt be nominated unanimously.
Later that same year, 1940, election night, Wendell Willkie was giving FDR his first real challenge since the New York Democrat won the White House in 1932. Calton Bourne and H.R. Baukage, another great commentator of that era, talk about the election, and note how Baukage, who speaks first, and Calton Bourne address each other.
"The thing that interests me is what's going to happen tomorrow, and when, and if he is defeated, what attitude he will take, whether he will come out then and pledge his support to the administration, or whether he will feel it's necessary to carry on some sort of expression, at least, of these principles of which he speaks. What do you think, Kaltenborn, about that?
Well, Balkage, I wonder if it wouldn't be worthwhile for us to repeat the words of Wendell Willkie insofar as we caught them in order that we may be in a better position to appraise them. Now, he began by saying, I have never felt better in my life. Now, that might mean one of two things. It might mean that he felt extremely well because he did not have to undertake the terrific burden of the presidency under the difficult conditions that now prevail. On the other hand, it may have also meant that he never felt better in his life simply because he's still in the thick of the fight and does not concede defeat.
The war, which internationalist Kaltenborn knew would eventually reach the shores of America, finally came on December the 7th, 1941.
Here is what has happened. President Roosevelt phoned Secretary Early half an hour ago that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, the United States naval base on Oahu Island in the Hawaiian Islands. A few minutes later, he again phoned Mr. Early and told him that planes had attacked Manila. This means that war is underway between Japan and the United States.
Midway through the war, while most Western commentators still hailed the Russians as our trustworthy allies, Kaltenborn paused to take a longer, less enchanted look. This is what he said 6 months before the invasion of France.
Good evening, everybody. It is becoming more and more evident that Soviet Russia expects to dominate post-war Europe. Joseph Stalin is entirely sincere in his desire to work with Britain and America in preserving peace, but he is also determined to put Russia in a position to maintain that peace by her own strength. That is why Russia now insists on having a pro-Russian government in Poland. That is why she has just presented an ultimatum to Finland. That is why she has organized German war prisoners into a German national committee to foment revolution in Germany. That is why she is giving her support to the communist partisans under Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia. That is why the Supreme Soviet yesterday authorized the 16 Russian republics to organize their own army units and an independent diplomatic service. If 16 separate Russian republics are represented at the peace conference and on all post-war organizations, they can exercise a highly important influence. They could certainly outvote the British Commonwealth of Nations, plus half a dozen other powers.
That familiar voice, the clipped sentences that had conveyed tidings of great moment through an historic decade, bore news of an unexpected tragedy one afternoon in April 20 years ago.
Good afternoon, everybody. The President of the United States died at 3:35 p.m. this afternoon in the Warm Springs environment that he loved so much. He dies at the end of an era. Few men have lived through so much. Few men have been privileged to lead their country under conditions of such tremendous difficulty and with such great success. For it was Franklin D. Roosevelt who led us from depression to recovery, who led us from war to what is now almost peace. And so, it is true that as he led us from depression to recovery, it was given to him to lead us into war, yes, and against his will, then through war to victory, but not yet to final peace.
Perhaps the one single broadcast for which H.V. Kaltenborn was best known was delivered by another man who was imitating him. It began on election night, 1948, when many polls and HV, too, foresaw defeat for President Harry Truman, who had sought re-election against Republican Thomas E. Dewey. Here's how Kaltenborn saw it late on election night.
Summing up all the figures that I have had, which I have managed to compare with those of 4 years ago, indicate a gain of anywhere from 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 10% for Dewey. I am inclined to think that while it is a very close race on the basis of the figures as they now stand on our board, Dewey has the best chance.
Of course, some of us knew then, all of us know now, how wrong he was. The next day, it became clear that Mr. Truman had been reelected, and later in the day, the president gleefully took to a microphone to rub it in.
And Mr. Kaltenbarn was saying, while the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear. That when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by another family.
But the historic exchange was not complete. Here is Kaltenbarn in his turn as he returned to the air the next day.
Last night, President Truman, in light-hearted mood, gave his electoral college hosts a side-splitting imitation of radio commentator H.V. Kaltenbarn making wrong predictions on election night. In doing that, and in the genial way in which he did it, he proved once again that for the next 4 years, we can all be human with Truman. Beware that man in place of power who has no sense of humor.
10 years ago, on my NBC News of the World program, I asked H.V., who had just completed his 33rd year on the air, to compare news broadcasting then, that is 1955, to the early days in the business.
Well, Morgan, I was an editorial writer for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle when I first became a radio commentator in 1922. Therefore, I began broadcasting by delivering spoken editorials. This meant that my chief task was to present a point of view on each topic. The news commentator's deliberate selection or omission of certain news topics is in itself an important exercise of editorial judgment. The question I always ask myself about a piece of news is, will this piece of news have any enduring importance? Our world position has become dominant since my radio career began. During my first decade of broadcasting, I felt that my most important editorial task was to help our people understand their new dominant role in world affairs. While news is important, news interpretation is far more important. It is a good omen that both in the press and on the air, news interpretation now occupies such an important place. Recently, going over my old broadcasts, made me aware of an interesting change in emphasis over the years. From 1922 to 32, I often spoke up for the League of Nations. After Hitler came to power in 32, my repeated interviews with him convinced me that Nazi Germany represented an immediate danger to world peace. Since 1945, I have concentrated on the communist danger. The 800 million people under communism have no access to the truth. They are weak because they are misinformed. Our strength lies in that freedom of speech which radio has done so much to promote. For 33 years, I have been allowed to say what I please.
That was 1955, just after H.V. had decided, at the spry age of 76, to call it quits. He gave up all his regular broadcasts and settled down to a life of relaxation and his favorite pastime, playing tennis. But world events continued to stir his active mind, and that clipped voice came over the airwaves frequently. Always a restless man, Kaltenbarn and his German-born wife traveled the world. He spent much of his spare time writing, and occasionally he was coaxed into a studio to lend his own special touch to a news broadcast. He continued to cover national political conventions for NBC until 1956. And even as late as last year, H.V. appeared on news programs to comment on the political scene. Kaltenborn delivered his own best epitaph 13 years ago in 1952 when the broadcasting industry honored him on the occasion of his 30th anniversary in radio.
I look back on 30 fascinating years in the development of this great new medium of communication, years which paralleled the growth of my native land into world leadership. 54 years ago, I was a soldier in the Spanish War that first made America a world power. 2 weeks ago, I returned from a reporter's survey trip through a Europe completely dependent on the United States for its economic support and its military defense. When you have been on the air as long as I have, you accumulate memories and a good deal of mail. For 30 years, I've saved the letters that have been written to me about my radio broadcasts. The attic in my home is filled with them. Each spring, my wife threatens a flaming holocaust. To make her see the importance of these historic treasures, I asked my secretary to start indexing this fan mail by topics. Looking over her files, I found one of the first folders captioned Animal Names. She has only covered 1922 and 23, but already there is a choice assortment of zoological characterizations. Here are a few of the animals of which I remind my early listeners. Pig, jackass, warthog, mule, vulture, snake, rat, monkey, louse, and skunk. Another folder was marked political. Under this, my secretary filed letters which called me fascist, communist, red-baiter, reactionary, Bolshevik, Republican, Democrat, socialist, prohibitionist, booze-hound, and even technocrat. Of course, this is flattering because it shows that even my early broadcasts stirred emotion and reaction. I have always remembered the biblical words, "So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth."
This is Morgan Beatty, NBC News.
You have been listening to The Dean of the Commentators, a special program in tribute to the memory of H.V. Kaltenborn, veteran NBC News commentator who died yesterday in New York. This program was produced by James L. Holton, directed by Daniel Field.
This is the NBC Radio Network.